Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, if you are used to having children in the house, you're used to watching out for them. Well, what parents can sometimes forget is our children are watching our every move too. They learn from us and they observe us and they look at our behaviours and oftentimes they copy our behaviours and we don't even notice. Sometimes we don't even notice we have behaviours until they start copying them. So for parents, what does this mean for drinking alcohol over Christmas and New Year? On the line now to tell us more, we have Miriam Tabor, Communications and Marketing Director, Manager at DrinkAware. You're very welcome to the show, Miriam. How are you doing?
Good morning. Really good, thanks.
So first of all, Miriam, it's been a busy time here and many of us will be hosting a dinner party or a New Year's party over the coming weeks. And often when a guest arrives in the door, our first question is, can I get you a drink? Is that true?
Absolutely. You know yourself, with Christmas coming up, and if it hasn't happened already, I'm sure it will happen for many of your listeners in the next week or so, between hosting family and friends at your own house or popping around to the neighbours. What are you going to have in your hand? It's probably going to be a bottle of wine or, you know, whatever your favourite drink is. So I suppose what we're really trying to say to parents and other adults who are around and other adult family members is that just to be mindful that children are more likely to be around adults who are drinking at Christmas because of all these additional social occasions. And as you quite rightly said in the intro, you know, children absorb everything. They look to their parents for all the influences in the world, even if parents don't necessarily think they're observing them or taking it all in. They absolutely are. And, you know, we do know that children have formed their opinions and attitudes about alcohol just from what they see in the world from a really young age. So it could be as young as like 5 or 6. So when all these social occasions kick off for Christmas, it's just for parents and other family members to be kind of positive role models. So we're saying to parents that, you know, when you have informed attitudes and behaviours around alcohol, that's really encouraging your child to do the same in the future.
Yeah, I hear from what you're saying, I can hear that there's a kind of a subtle permissioning. Yeah, I'm not saying that you would say it's okay for you to drink, but what you're doing is you're kind of modelling something, aren't you?
Absolutely. Like, we're not here to judge parents or other family members, and we're certainly not here to be any sort of bah humbug at Christmas. You
sure,
know,
sure.
It is a time for celebrating. But I suppose we did some research with parents last year to inform our parents' workshops and campaigns. And parents, 78% of parents cite family occasions and celebrations as the top time when their children are exposed to them drinking alcohol.
Mm.
And a key point there is that almost half of these said that this was likely happening in their home. And I suppose this is a really pertinent point for Christmas, you know, because of all those kind of popping around to neighbours and everything that we talked about. But also, you know, we do know that home drinking is now the norm in Ireland.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you about that. The sense that we were getting, the narrative was this was to do with the price of alcohol in pubs compared with, you know, in supermarkets where it was being kind of, oftentimes it was a loss leader. But we won't go into that. We won't go down that particular rabbit hole at the moment. But the point is that, is it your kind of experience, or is research showing that there's more drinking going on in the household than there was before?
Yeah, absolutely. So our DrinkAware Index shows that 61% of drinking occasions among Irish adults now happens in the home.
Right.
So that's a huge, huge number. So it's clear that we've shifted from the traditional pub culture in Ireland to drinking at home. And you know yourself, drinking at home presents its own issues because it's a really comfortable environment. It's easier to drink more than you intended. And you know, we so often hear, we run workshops all around the country, and one of the top things that we hear these days is, well, I only set out to have a glass of wine or a beer in front of the telly, and all of a sudden, you know, I've gone through a few cans of beer, gone through half a bottle of wine, and I really didn't mean to.
Exactly.
So one of the top things that we would say to people, especially around spirits or wine, consuming it in the home, is, you know, it's a really easy tip, but we forget it, is never free pour. It makes it nearly impossible to know how much you, or indeed at Christmas, your guests are drinking.
And okay, so explain that to me.
Yeah, so basically when people pour alcohol at home, you know, glass sizes are bigger, especially wine glasses now.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to say is use a measure. We have one available for free at our website at drinkware.ie, which is a really popular tool. And what that shows people is standard drink measures.
Yeah, so there's a kind of an accountability in it. You're saying something to me here, and I've this memory of when the really big glasses started coming out, and I remember people that I knew of just used to go out buy a bottle of wine and just literally put half of it into one glass, half of it into the other glass, and that was your wine for the night. Now, in fairness, there is a kind of a measure element to that, but it's like, wow, that you could get half a bottle of wine into a glass is mad, you know.
It and the rest sometimes with sunglasses. You know, we do demonstrations at our workshops and we ask people to, you know, very brave souls to come up to the top and pour what they would usually pour at home. Yeah. And then we pour that into our standard drink measure. And one standard drink of wine is 100 mils.
Right.
So when you think of the realistic kind of nature of that, we all know we're not going to go to a pub or a restaurant and get a 100 mil glass of wine.
Exactly.
But what we're trying to say to people is, you have the control at home. You know, our measure is there with all of those markings. So it's just to keep that in mind, that that's available for people. Because as I say, free pouring your drink and also topping up glasses really makes it so hard for yourself and your guests to understand. And that's a huge thing at Christmas or weddings or, you know, celebrations in general. So you'll have a bit more, but you know, it's up to the person themselves, I suppose, how much they want to drink.
Yeah, that measure idea is a really good idea, actually. And I was thinking, you know, it makes me realise, you know, we had all these incredible rituals, I suppose you could say, around pub culture, which was designed to keep some sort of a control on things. And this kind of rise of drinking at home, there's no really rituals around it. You know, there's no, you know, we haven't created a kind of set of rules for ourselves. So as a result, the idea of, like, even the way the phrase you use, free pouring, gives you an idea that, you know, you literally could be pouring any amount of alcohol, really.
You could, and I think, like, that's a really good point, because, you know, it's not only wine, it is spirits as well, and we talk of the size of wine glasses. Sure, we've all seen the size of gin glasses now, and,
exactly,
you know, they're big balloon glasses.
Absolutely.
So if somebody has them in their house, you know, if they pour a measure in, chances are it's going to be a bit more than a standard drink measure. So one of the things that shocks people the most is one standard drink of spirits is the same as a pub measure.
Mm.
So nobody would ever go back to the bar and say, well, that measure is not big enough. Mm. But we do have this mindset going, it might look a bit small in the home, or, you know, that doesn't look right, so you might pour in a bit more. But again, our standard drink measure has those markings. So they're little tips that people can keep in mind. And once you use it a few times, your eye will start to know, hang on a second, I've gone too far, you know.
So it's
things like that. And I suppose standard drinks, why we go on about standard drinks all the time is really important, because the HSE low risk weekly guidelines for adults for women are 11 standard drinks spread out over the week.
Yeah.
So that's the equivalent of about 1.5 bottles of wine.
Yeah, over a week.
Over a week.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's 12.5% wine.
Yeah.
And something we keep hearing a lot now is that it's getting harder and harder to get 12.5%.
You're absolutely, I frequently see it 13, 14%. Yeah, normal.
And that all adds to the standard drink content. So then for men, it's 17 standard drinks in the week. So that's the equivalent of about 8.5 pints.
Yeah.
So, you know, for some people that really shocks them, going, oh my gosh. But for other people, that could be, you know, they wouldn't have that in a month. So everyone's different, you know.
And of course, remembering that, you know, you don't save it up and have the 7.5 or 8 pints on the one night.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's such a key point. And the other point there is, you know, to have at least 2 alcohol-free days in the week. So that just gives your body time to, you know, recharge.
Recover.
And exactly. So
just very quickly, you know, going back to the idea of kids and children, you know, what advice do you have for parents who might have teenagers who are turning 18 around this time of year? Now, I know for most, those teenagers have already, you know, experimented with alcohol, and, you know, some of them have been drunk in the past. But what, in terms of trying to just have some sort of a responsible, you know, modeling at home, what would you suggest?
So, like, I think one of the first things that we'd say is that for under-18s, make sure that alcohol isn't accessible or the central focus of a party. So, like we were saying there, when, you know, we opened the door and everything, maybe the first thing you don't say is would you like a drink? It's come on in, you know, sit down, catch up with everybody, and then, you know, the drink might come later.
Yeah.
But also, just access for children is key. So, keeping alcohol separate from, you know, where the kids' drinks are or where the food is, you know, because it's really important to provide food and snacks for everybody. So maybe keep that out of sight, or definitely out of the way of the soft drinks or the water or the food that the children might be going up to throughout the night. But I think a really key thing these days is to have loads of alcohol-free options in the house and keep them visible, because that helps, you know, children to know that actually alcohol isn't a central focus of this party and it's not needed to celebrate. Yes, it can add to an occasion, but it's really not the only option that people have, because we know that there are so many different types of, you know, spirits now, beers, ciders, wines that have no alcohol in them. So it's really becoming a bit of a norm, which we're kind of, we're really happy about. So there's a lot more available now. So all of those alternatives for people, and especially if you're visiting house to house, you know, drink driving is a huge consideration. So if you are hosting people in your house, it's really important to have no alcohol options available so that they can, you know, be partaking in the festivities and everything, but still not.
It's a kind of, it's considerate, isn't it, to have something.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yep. Listen, Miriam, lovely talking to you, and very happy Christmas to you, and God bless you. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope. Miriam Tabor, Communications and Marketing Manager at DrinkAware, thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless you. And to say that the website there is drinkaware.ie. Concern continues around the number of people homeless, those living on our streets and in emergency accommodation. It's been reported that the homelessness crisis has reached the highest level on record, with over 10,500 people living in emergency accommodation. Our next guest is a tireless campaigner for the homeless and is known for his National Housing and Homeless Charity. And on the line we have the man himself, Father Peter McVerry of the Peter McVerry National Housing and Homeless Charity. Very welcome to the show, Father Peter. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Niamh. Thank you.
Yeah. First of all, Father Peter, how is the situation looking as we head into another winter?
It's looking awful and probably going to get worse.
Right.
And the official figures underestimate considerably the number of homeless people. For example, the 10,500 who are registered as homeless, that number doesn't include people sleeping rough. Surprisingly,
yeah, isn't that amazing? How many? What's your sense of that? I mean, what would you add to that 10,500 if you put in the rough sleepers?
Somewhere maybe between 100 and 200.
Gosh, and then couch surfers as well.
It doesn't include sofa surfing.
I
think we're talking there probably of a few thousand people.
Gosh,
it doesn't include 800 refugees who are still living in direct provision, but they've been granted permission to stay in Ireland, but they can't move out because they can't find accommodation. It doesn't include women and children living in refuges who are fleeing domestic violence, but who have nowhere else to go. It doesn't include about 200 homeless people living in hostels like the Ivy Hostel and the Morning Star in the Back Lane. So I would guess that the number of homeless people is actually nearer or above 15,000 rather than the 10,000.
Wow.
And if you added in, as some countries do, if you added in those adults who are still living involuntarily with their parents, can't afford to move out.
You could double that.
We'd be talking about 100,000.
Yeah, you're right.
So the figures grossly underestimate the number of people who are without a home. And who would like to have a home.
Talking about the triage, I suppose, have we managed to stop the people who are still being made homeless, or are there still people being made homeless today?
No, Focus Ireland would say that they can house one homeless family every day, but there are three families presenting as homeless every day.
Three. Oh my goodness.
And the number of homeless single people continues to rise. 70% of those presenting today as homeless are being evicted from the private rented sector because the landlord says they're selling the house. And we have got to stop that flow into homelessness. Until we stop that flow, trying to house homeless people and homeless families is like trying to empty the bathwater with the taps full on.
Yeah.
We've got to stop that flow, and there is very, very little in government policy to address that. Twice proposals have been put to the Dáil to make it illegal for a limited period of time, maybe 2 to 3 years, to make it illegal to evict people into homelessness. Twice the government have voted against that.
Reneged on it. Honestly, even the notion of that is like mind-boggling. But you've been doing this an awful long time. Is this absolutely the worst that you've seen?
Oh, by far the worst.
Yeah.
I started in the 70s, and, you know, the number of homeless people was a fraction of what it is today. Even in 1996, and I was looking back over reports then, the number of homeless people in 1996 was 2,500. And then I predicted a tsunami of homelessness coming down the road, and the number I used was 5,000.
Yeah, I know.
And now we're way about treble that in terms of the number of homeless people. It has never, ever been so bad. And the really frightening thing are the families being made homeless, because the damage that is being done to children has been well documented. The children become withdrawn, they become aggressive, their relationship with their parents can be jeopardized, their education can be jeopardized, their mental health is under threat. The damage, and with the single homeless people, at least you can get a building and you can put in some beds and you can offer a homeless person a bed, but you can't do that for families.
Yeah, exactly.
So really, the emergence of families, back in 2012, there were no such thing as homeless families in this country.
Yeah, well, exactly. That is a new thing that has emerged through this. And I remember back at just as the crash was happening, somebody saying to me, it's like if everybody takes three steps down on a ladder, what happens to the people who are on the three bottom steps of the ladder? And they kind of tried to explain it to me, but I had no clue what we were going to, you know, experience. Can I ask you a question? You know, we always ask the question, what's to be done? And I'm sure you're sick answering this question. And, but if we were to plug the kind of landlord thing, the ability to be able to say, oh, look, I'm selling the house, or I'm going to be, you know, and I have to get rid of, you know, if we did that much, do you think that would make some difference?
It would give us a chance to get on top of the problem that we have, without the problem continuing to increase substantially. It would allow us to address that problem. And there's two ways of addressing that problem. We've got to start building social housing on a much, much bigger scale. You know, in this country, in 1975, this country built 8,500 council houses.
Yeah.
In 1985, this country built 6,900 council houses. And in 2015, this country built 75 council houses.
Yeah.
And that's a large part of the problem. We're never going to solve this problem unless we go back to building houses which are owned and controlled by the government or the local.
And I'm just thinking, you know, we built those in the 1930s and 40s when there was absolutely, the government had no money at all.
That's right.
And you know, it seemed, you know, it was funny.
It was seen then, building council housing was seen then as an investment.
Yeah.
And we've got to go back to seeing building social housing as an investment, which is just as important as transport or broadband or any of the other things that we consider important. Council housing for people on low incomes is a vital, vital investment for our country.
It was in one of the headlines yesterday was, if we manage to build 90 houses a day for the next 10 years, we'll sort it. So 90 houses a day, it's some challenge, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, all the experts say we need at least 35,000 houses a year. That's not to deal with the homeless crisis. That's to deal with the expanding population.
That's just to stand still.
Year we built 18,000 houses. This year we're on target for about 22,000 houses. Far, far short of what is needed. So the problem just continues to grow.
Yeah.
And the fear is there's 40,000 mortgages in arrears of more than 2 years. And the majority of those are going to end up being repossessed one way or the other, either by the banks or vulture funds.
Another 40,000 homeless families?
40,000 families becoming, potentially, well, they won't all become homeless. Some will go and live with their families. Some will emigrate to England or Australia.
Yeah.
But if even a fraction of those become homeless, this country won't be able to cope.
Yeah.
So I think we have a crisis now. We could have a catastrophe. in 3 or 4 years' time unless this problem is addressed.
So do you think, Father Peter, do you think there's a kind of an ideological problem the government has with building social housing, or do you think that they will eventually get around to it?
I think there's partly an ideological problem, and this decision was made about 20 years ago that the private sector should provide council housing, basically. And the main mechanism for that was the private rented sector.
Okay.
And the government said, we give people a subsidy to enable them to pay for the rent in the private rented sector. That was an ideological decision.
It was, yeah.
Private sector should provide. But the other aspect of it is, the government, local authorities don't want social housing. They don't want to manage social housing, because managing social housing can be difficult. You're kind of some difficult tenants. You have,
sure.
You can have antisocial behaviour. You can have drugs. Well, that happens everywhere. But they don't want to manage social housing, and so they pass the buck onto the private sector.
Yeah, and that private sector is kind of failing us now, probably, it'd be fair to say.
Well, it can't cope.
Yeah.
If you go looking for to rent an apartment or a house now, particularly in Dublin, you'll have 40 people outside queuing up to view it. Private sector simply can't cope. So it's a policy that has failed and will continue to fail, but it's still government policy. If you read their strategy on homelessness and housing, they want 3 out of every 4 people on the social housing waiting list and who are homeless to find their accommodation in the private rented sector. That's still government policy, that ideology of using the private rented sector.
Yeah. So you've given us some ideas about how we might help change policy. You've given us some ideas about, you know, how, you know, government might act. Is there anything, I mean, I'm imagining, like, listeners to Spirit Radio just listening in now and feeling quite helpless, and have been feeling helpless for quite a number of years now. Is there anything the average person can do to help make the homelessness situation better?
Well, the first and I think very important thing, if you do pass people who are on the street who are homeless, just have a word with them. Don't pass them by as if they didn't exist.
Very good.
I think that's, you know, just to be able to, what I often say when I'm passing by is, look, I'm sorry, I don't have any change on me.
Yeah.
And you know what the answer often is? The answer often is, well, that's okay, thanks. What's the thanks for? The thanks is for just not having ignored them as you pass by.
Gosh.
The other thing we would like is to get the right to housing into the Constitution. Now,
right.
The government are adamantly opposed to that. But we have the right to education in the Constitution.
Yeah, it's
and
crazy.
And because
yeah.
of that, every child in this country is entitled by law to an education.
Yeah.
We could get the right to housing into the Constitution.
So you're not actually, you're not entitled constitutionally to have a roof over your head. You're not entitled
no,
to that.
No, you're not. You're
That's
not,
mad.
Absolutely not. That case has been taken several times by the Mercy Law Centre, and they have lost it. You have no entitlement to a roof over your head.
Gosh,
and
mad.
The most frightening thing is, you know, if you're a 4 or 5 or a 14 or a 15-year-old child homeless with your family, that child has no right to a roof over its head.
Yeah. So how do we agitate for that, Father Peter?
I think we need to build up a momentum, sending emails, letters to the minister, to the Taoiseach, to get that right to housing into the Constitution.
Very,
it doesn't mean
good.
That the day after the referendum...
No, I get it, yeah.
But it puts pressure on government to give housing a priority, which it doesn't have at the moment, and it puts pressure on government to produce policies and a timeline, maybe 15 years. But at the end of that timeline, everybody would have the right to housing provided for them. So,
like you say, you see the changes made in terms of education. You know, when a child doesn't turn up for education, there's a load of people going after them, going, "Where are you and what are you?" So, in the same way, if that applied for having a roof over your head, I'm sure the policies would follow. Listen, it's lovely talking to you, Father Peter. Very happy and holy Christmas to you, social justice campaigner Father Peter McVerry. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Pleasure.
God bless you. Now, in our weekly Life in 5 interview, we get to talk to someone about their life, its ups and downs, and how they might have seen God at work in it all. And they do it by answering 5 questions that they choose from a short list. Our Life in 5 guest this week is Carol Hennessy, the project manager of the Team Hope Christmas Shoebox Appeal. Spirit Radio's Lizzie Wilson caught up with Carol at the Fearless Women's Conference, where Carol was honoured. This is their conversation, and listen out for when her birthday is.
I'm married to Dave and we have two grown-up children, Sarah and Clive. And as you mentioned, I'm Team Hope's Christmas Shoebox Appeal Manager and I also love doing summer camps during the summer with kids in Eastern Europe.
Well, thanks to God's touch in your life, there's hardly a child in this country who doesn't know what a shoebox is really for beyond having a pair of shoes in it. Where did it all begin with Team Hope and the Christmas Shoebox Appeal?
I guess for me it began many years ago when my own children were 8 and 6 and I wanted them to learn how to care and share for others less fortunate than themselves. And I read about the Shoebox Appeal. I thought this is a great way to help get them started, and it snowballed from there. Got friends involved and it took off, and last year we sent 259,079 shoeboxes to children in Eastern Europe and Africa. It's a huge team effort and I'm just amazed by the kindness of everybody in Ireland.
So the snowballing started with 14 little flakes of snow representing 14 shoeboxes and now has grown to a rather large snowball of over 250,000 shoeboxes, and I reckon 500,000 is what you should aim for this year. Well done. Do you have a favourite Bible verse and why?
Yes, my favourite Bible verse is Psalm 46 verse 1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And I just love that verse because God is always there with us. He's the person we can go to, run to. He's our refuge and he's only a prayer away. And all of us face difficult days, days when we need grace and strength. And he provides that strength for us. And that verse has just encouraged me so many times in my life. And it's so reassuring to know that God is always with us.
That's lovely, and I know you wouldn't be where you are today had it not been for that sort of sense and that real assurance of God's presence and his strength in your life. And how does he help you in your everyday work and life?
He keeps me, the joy of the Lord is our strength, so he keeps me going. It's, you know, working with over 2,000 volunteers around Ireland isn't easy. It has great joys and, you know, there's always challenges along the way, but God sees us through. But when we are out in Eastern Europe and Africa and I'm meeting the children and their families, there are so many heartbreaking situations. You know, you've child-headed households in Swaziland. Parents have died from AIDS and children as young as 10 are looking after their younger brothers and sisters. You meet kids in orphanages. You see children in street shelters, children living on rubbish dumps, trying to survive, trying to salvage some food and some hope. And just to meet these children and your heart breaks and it's, you know, you just draw on the strength and the grace that God gives you for the moment. And he does that. He provides that grace and strength, which I'm so thankful for.
And what has become your everyday life, which is your life work, how do you see God in the midst of all that? There's so much that you've just described. How do you see him and where do you see him in the midst of it?
I see God all around me. I see God in the beauty of nature from the moment we wake up in the morning to we hear the birds singing to the trees, whatever the day is like. I just love all the seasons. But more importantly, I love people and I just love the way you see God in people through a friendly smile, through children just playing, through friends, through family, through the stranger on the street, through interacting with people. I see God at work.
A testing time in your life, I'm sure there have been many, but is there one that particularly stands out to you that you'd like to share with us today?
Yes, like everybody, we all have our challenges, and I think my most difficult time was when both my parents died from cancer in 2008, and it was only 6 months apart. My mum died in February and dad the following October, and that was very, very difficult, very challenging. But God was with me through all that. And, you know, just even reading the Psalms quietly to my dad as he lay in hospital and praying, and just with the help of friends and prayer support, it was just God got me through.
thank you for sharing that tough time in your life and to be able to come through the other side. And in the midst of it all, there's joy in what you're doing. But what really makes you happy?
What makes me happy? I love being with my family and being with close friends. Nothing makes me happier. And I just love being by the sea and out in nature. I am very, very happy to be walking along the beach, walking along a promenade, breathing the fresh sea air. I grew up in the west of Ireland and there's nothing like the fresh Atlantic air.
You're right, I would agree with you on that one. There's something that most people would not know about you. You share your birthday with a very famous person, a very special person. You're both centre stage.
Yes, Susie, you happen to know I share my birthday with JC, as you said, Jesus Christ. December the 25th, my poor husband can never forget it.
Well, I think that's beautifully ironic for you, Carol, because the one thing that people would see is a dud birthday because everybody's preoccupied with other things. I'm a Christmas baby as well, just after Christmas, but people think you get the short straw. But actually, you've turned around and God's empowered you to turn it around into something beautiful. You've turned his birthday and your birthday into a celebration of Christmas, God with you and God with millions of children around the world because of how you've filled shoeboxes and empowered others to do so and gathered those around you to be part of this incredible vision that is Team Hope. Thank you for your time today, Carol.
Thank you, Izzy. It's been a privilege and an honour to be here.
That was Lizzie Wilson speaking to Carol Hennessy, the project manager of the Team Hope Christmas Shoebox Appeal, and whose birthday is Christmas Day, as you heard. Carol was on the roll of honour at the recent Fearless Women's Conference. And we will be continuing the Life in 5 series every Thursday, shortly after 11. Now, over 100 cribs from all around the world will be on display in Blessington Parish this weekend. These cribs have been donated or on loan to the parish, and Pope Francis has also been in contact ahead of this exhibition. On the line now to tell us more, we have Áine Egan, pastoral worker in the Dublin Archdiocese and Blessington Parish. You are very welcome to the show, Áine. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing very well.
First of all, Áine, tell us about Blessington Parish and how the idea for this exhibition came about.
Well, we're a parish, a country parish, just outside Dublin, about 20 minutes outside Dublin, and Father Richard, being our parish priest, is a parish priest of a few parishes, as is the norm now in these days, and we were sitting around having a cup of tea and we were just discussing the World Meeting of Families and how could we follow on the Pope's message about family life and faith in family life. So this is what inspired us to kind of our outreach to family ministry, and we decided then at Christmas time we would just bring back the central role of the Holy Family in our lives. So we have an exhibition of cribs. So that's where the kind of the kernel of the idea was, around the coffee morning. And we decided then that we would write to a lot of our pastoral leaders. And we did write to some political leaders as well, see would they gift us with a crib or loan us out a crib for the exhibition. And we did get responses. So, and the Pope did write back a lovely letter.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's great. That's lovely.
Yeah.
And I believe you've got a great array of different kinds of cribs and nativities on display. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yep. We, through our discussions with people, we found out that people really have a special connection to their cribs. We have cribs made from volcanic ash.
Wow.
We have a crib made from a refugee from the Dominican Republic of Congo. We have a crib from Chile that families made these cribs to support families of the disappeared during the regime of Pinochet. We have another crib from the Philippines that was made from the Dolls House Project. And these were a project set up to give loans to Filipino women so they could use sewing machines to make cribs so that they could make a living for themselves. We have hand-carved cribs, knitted cribs, paper mache, abstract, traditional. We have a crib made of brushes.
Brilliant. You've one made out of banana leaves. That's amazing.
Banana leaves.
What does that look like?
Yeah. And maize leaves or corn on the cob leaves, and that one's from Hungary. We have cribs from all continents.
Amazing. You know, it's really funny. I was thinking, myself and Joanne, we were married kind of in late November, and somebody had the brilliant idea of giving us a crib as a Christmas, as a wedding present. And it's one of, it's really, it's, you know, you talk about people having a very strong connection to their, it was such a beautiful thing to get, and we were thrilled with it, you know. So this exhibition, it's for all ages to enjoy, I believe.
Yes, all ages. We're hoping that, and it's a conversation that grannies can have with their grandchildren, and parents can come with their own parents, and it's for all ages. I showed a few of the smaller cribs to three little children yesterday evening, and they were fascinated. So I know that it's going to appeal to all ages in families. And it's a lovely afternoon out, you know, get away from the hustle and bustle of the shopping at this time.
Absolutely.
So we have one crib here. It's a very special crib. We have the Archdeacon of Glendalough here, Father Kevin Lyons. He's close to 90 now. He was gifted a crib on the day of his baptism by his godfather.
Wow,
yeah. So he has loaned that to us for the exhibition. So we have really beautiful, meaningful cribs on display to different people, you know, so...
Lovely. Oh, that's really special. I have to say, it sounds absolutely gorgeous and charming on top of everything else.
Yes.
There's something about cribs that are just really attractive and lovely.
Yes.
And then you've got a great array. So are you doing it in the church, or are you doing it in the pastoral centre, or what are you doing in the parish centre, should I say?
We are doing it in the parish centre, the Communion Centre. It's a beautiful new centre.
Okay.
We begin with the healing mass at 12 o'clock on Saturday, and we'll have a special opening and blessing of the cribs then straight after the healing mass. We will continue on and leave it open until 8 o'clock in the evening.
So 1 o'clock till 8 o'clock on Saturday?
Yes. And then on Sunday, we open up again after 10 o'clock Mass. And we have a carol service at 5 o'clock.
Wow.
And so people can come in after the carol service as well. And then we will close it again at 8 o'clock.
So 11 o'clock until 8 o'clock
yes.
on Sunday. And then and I believe you're opening on Monday as well.
Yes. We have invited all the schools in the locality to come. One is across the road and one is beside us. So we're hoping all the school children will come in if they haven't had a chance over the weekend.
And you have more than 100 exhibits, so it's like there's lots there.
Yes.
Lots to look at.
We have hand-carved, knitted, papier-mâché, one-made of brushes.
Yeah, you were saying that. And tell me, was there a lot of kind of organising in it? I mean, when you think of 100 items from all over the world, did it take you ages to make contact with people and collect them and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, we had to be very careful to make sure that the cribs that were loaned to us will be returned
exactly.
in the condition that they were given to us. So we're very aware of that. And we have a priest in Dublin, Father Liam O'Keefe, who was very good to us. He's a collector of cribs, so he was very good to us. And all of the priests in the parish have all given their choice of crib to the exhibition, as has the two girls in the office, Jean and Carl. So, we're looking forward to it. It has been I wouldn't say it was hard work. It was kind of a lovely idea and lovely to be part of it. And it built up and the excitement is getting greater and greater.
So just for those who aren't really that familiar with the geography of the place, you're heading kind of out of Dublin on the N81, am I right?
Yes.
And you hit Blessington. Whereabouts
yes.
is the parish centre?
The parish centre is across the road from the K Circle garage, and as you're coming out of Dublin, it is on your left-hand side.
Okay.
And there's lots of parking.
Great, and that's the far end of the...
It's the Dublin end.
It's the Dublin end. Okay,
yeah.
Great. I'm coming from... I'd be coming over the Wicklow Gap to you because I'm in Roundwood, so...
All right.
I'd be coming the opposite direction, but that's great. So
yeah.
Brilliant. So I'll tell you what, it's an absolutely lovely idea. Is there any charge?
No.
It's free.
No charge.
Okay, lovely,
yeah.
Lovely. I wish you the very best with it. Just to let everybody know again, it's at the Cumming Centre in Blessington. It's on Saturday the 14th between 1 and 8, Sunday the 15th between 11 and 8, and Monday the 16th between 10 and 4. Over 100 exhibits of cribs from around the world. Anya Egan, pastoral worker in the Dublin Archdiocese and Blessington Parish, thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless you. And just to say, if you want to check it out, blessingtonparish.ie is their website.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.